Welcome to Reining in the Bulls with Michael Marks. Today's guest is Kathy Mulvey. She is currently the Climate Accountability Campaign Director with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Following the podcast, enjoy a bonus interlude between Michael and Kathy about how she first became involved in campaign movements. In this Reining in the Bulls episode, Kathy will discuss the campaign challenge of altering tobacco companies' marketing and promotional tactics and interfering with public policy. This groundbreaking campaign was titled Challenging Big Tobacco.
Kathy Mulvey, thanks for joining me for this interview.
Yeah, thanks, Michael.
We're going to talk about the tobacco industry. You are with the Union of Concerned Scientists today. But during the tobacco campaign, you were with Corporate Accountability International.
Yes, it was in fact at the start of that campaign and now Corporate Accountability.
What was Corporate Accountability's mission and what was your position with them then?
The organization's mission is a big one: to stop life-threatening abuses by transnational corporations and increase their accountability to people around the world. Mm-hmm. And during the work on tobacco, I played a number of different roles, starting as our director of campaign development and then becoming executive director during that campaign.
The tobacco campaign really targeted the entire industry, but did Corporate Accountability focus on the entire industry, or strategically did it focus on one or more companies? And to kind of illustrate this story.
The organization's model of campaigning and theory and sort of approach to campaigning was to issue demands to the industry as a whole, but to target the campaigning on leaders in the industry. And mm-hmm. So for the tobacco industry campaign, that was actually the, which is now Challenging Big Tobacco campaign, that was Philip Morris as the world's largest and most profitable tobacco transnational. And there's been some changes in corporate structure since then. And then RJR, what was then RJR Nabisco, because of the egregious visible marketing to young people, and specifically the Joe Camel campaign at that time was quite visible. And, you know, recognized, I mean, a cartoon character used to market cigarettes.
Yes. No, I remember it well. Well, what was it that influenced Corporate Accountability to take on the tobacco industry? Because I know historically, Corporate Accountability at one time was actually InFact, and they took on Nestle's and the baby form for the baby formula campaign, which was one of the first major international corporate campaigns. What was it, though, that challenged them and made them want to really take on tobacco?
We were coming out of, as you mentioned, that background with Nestle, and then more recently a campaign on the nuclear weapons industry, highlighting the industrial part of the nuclear weapons complex and targeting General Electric as the leader in both producing and promoting nuclear weapons. And so as General Electric actually was, through that campaign, removed as a driving force behind the nuclear weapons industry, we actually took stock as an organization. We looked at a whole range of issues of corporate abuse and harm to people around the world, everything from, you know, from pesticides to issues around, corporate power and international trade agreements and agribusiness. I mean, we did a range of research and set really criteria for a grassroots corporate campaign. And tobacco came to the top of that, investigation and also polling of supporters and of the organization for a couple of reasons. One was the enormous preventable global death toll from tobacco, which at the time was 3 million people a year and projected to rise to 10 million a year. And the other was the power and political influence of these corporations and their ability to obstruct public health policy. And so that was really what came down to it. And, you know, as a membership organization, we did a survey of our members and we did a lot of individual personal visits. And people really loved or hated the idea of us taking on the tobacco industry. It's kind of interesting because one of the really powerful ways that the tobacco corporations manipulated people and policy was through this mythology of choice, you know, with an addictive product. I would say one of the big accomplishments of that campaign was really shifting it in the public consciousness, you know, with the others involved in this movement, but shifting it from a question of personal responsibility to one of corporate accountability and the public climate work that happened through that visible campaigning. So we experienced some of that when we rolled out the campaign to our members. You know, some of our own members just didn't think that it was necessarily an issue for a corporate accountability organization to take on.
Now, I know, and you've alluded to it, that the harm associated with tobacco smoking was pretty much well documented. Did corporate accountability need to put out any additional reports or anything of that sort to help kind of change the perception of the industry? And as you just alluded to, that sense that whether there really is a choice when the company knows it's addictive.
We were not the scientists and public health experts, right? There was, dating back to the 60s, there were tens of thousands of studies of the harms caused by tobacco. What we did was to document the marketing and promotion of tobacco products to people in the US, but particularly globally, and the export of a preventable epidemic. So we published a book called Global Aggression, Philip Morris Craft and Global Tobacco Addiction, which was a really important gathering of evidence from allies and partners around the world. We then actually worked with documentary filmmakers on a film called Making a Killing, which look where the filmmakers went to the Czech Republic and Vietnam and had a chance to talk with experts on the ground, but also, you know, show people visually the ways that Philip Morris in particular was spreading tobacco addiction around the world. So those were a couple things. And then early in the campaign, you know, and I can talk more about this, but millions of pages of previously secret internal corporate documents came into the public domain thanks to litigation against the tobacco corporations. And those were really important for us in terms of understanding, you know, getting a view inside the corporation, Philip Morris in particular, as to how the top leaders were trying to respond to and thwart our campaign. And so we also published a report called Secrets and Lies, which was based on those internal documents and how the companies were responding to the boycott campaign.
You mentioned that Philip Morris was part of was chosen in part because of Joe Camel, the cartoon figure. Was part of the strategy or the framing of the campaign for corporate accountability also emphasizing its impact on children? Early addiction?
Yes. So Philip Morris was actually the Marlboro Man, and RJR Nabisco was Joe Camel.
Okay.
And yes, one of the top demands of the campaign was to stop advertising and promotion that appeals to children and young people. And, you know, the studies that we were looking at showed that the average age of starting to consume tobacco products was 14. And so, and that was a big part of shifting people's understanding to recognize this as an issue of corporate abuse. And one of the ways that we engaged our members and beyond was through a campaign project called The Human Toll of Tobacco, where we gathered photos and stories of loved ones people had lost to tobacco addiction. Mm. And when we asked people to say, you know, tell us about your uncle, if you've sent this photo, how old was he when he started to smoke? And inevitably it was, you know, they were young teenagers. And so that really got people thinking. And, you know, it was around that same time that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration started to investigate nicotine in tobacco products and found that tobacco companies were actually engineering their products to ensure that they were delivering nicotine at a level necessary to maintain addiction. And of course, you know, right around the time that we launched the campaign in 1994, there were really iconic hearings chaired by Representative Henry Waxman in the House Oversight Committee, where, you know, I'm sure a lot of people will remember the CEO standing up to swear that they believed nicotine was not addictive. So,
right.
You know, this is just a signature issue of corporate abuse, where you have corporations targeting young people with an addictive product that kills so many of its users.
That leads me to ask, and it may be obvious, but when you sat down at the beginning and said, okay, what's the theory of change that's going to drive our campaign? What was that theory?
The campaign was really about getting these corporations to stop hooking young people, right, and to get out of the way of public health policy making. And what we were really setting out to do was to organize, you know, large numbers of people to, you know, recognize this as an issue of corporate accountability, to see how tobacco companies were actually hiding behind food brands. So it was to essentially separate, you know, to make it more difficult for these corporations to draw on the legitimacy of their food businesses, and to make the political leaders who were covering for the tobacco companies pay the consequences, right? Mm-hmm. So fundamentally, as you know, Michael, I mean, these corporate campaigns are, in my view, they're about changing the cost-benefit ratio for corporations to engage in abusive practices, right? And when we power mapped the tobacco companies, you know, they were getting all these benefits out of owning food brands without suffering from that. They got to, their lobbyists got to influence policymaking, oppose tobacco taxes, wearing the Kraft brand, you know, making or Oscar Mayer. Executives and marketers, I mean, they're ad agencies like Leo Burnett. Sure, they had the Marlboro Man, which is, you know, one of the most effective youth marketing campaigns of all time. Nice. You know, but also the Kraft brands, which were seen as so wholesome, right? And so to make those, to drive a wedge there with their ad agencies, with the media outlets that they were advertising in, and you know, they just had a stranglehold over U.S. public policy. Wow. I mean, there had been not a single piece of major tobacco control legislation passed, and they were paying a lot of money to our political leaders. And so it was really about making those connections visible. Big tobacco had a negative reputation, but that wasn't rubbing off on a lot of other people and entities that were benefiting from the ill-gotten gains of this industry, right? So it was to really drive wedges and isolate them from that legitimacy and political power.
So that leads me to ask the question, given that there's the issue of the harm they're causing, there's the issue of the political influence that they have. I seem to recall there were a number of NGO allies that you, that Corporate Accountability had in this campaign. Who were they, some of the most prominent ones that you, and how were you guys organized, or were you? I mean, how was it, like an alliance? Was it a coalition? Was it a network? Or was it pretty independent, just keeping each other informed?
So there, I mean, there were different relationships, I think, with different allies and partners, right? So the public health, the mainstream public health organizations, had very large bases that they could reach and communicate with. Now, you know, in the early stages of the campaign, they weren't necessarily that enthusiastic about exposing the influence, the food businesses of these tobacco companies. Public education about the ills of tobacco was fine, but public education about the control that these corporations had over major food brands, you know, we found was a little more difficult to crack. The roots of InFACT and then which became Corporate Accountability, were in the faith community. It actually grew out of the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, which has, you know, been leading shareholder advocacy on a range of issues for decades now. So the faith community was critically important ally. Even by the time we started working on on challenging big tobacco in the early 90s, many faith-based investors had already divested, but they still were using the power of the proxy to get in and raise concerns about, you know, international expansion and other issues with corporate decision makers. So that was an important alliance. There were affected communities. That big tobacco has long targeted Black communities in the U.S. with its menthol cigarettes. And so, you know, working with organizations like the National Association of African Americans for Positive Imagery, working with youth led campaigns at the local level were other important alliances in the US. And then internationally, there had been a lot of work before we got into the arena through Consumers International as an umbrella federation, essentially, of consumer groups around the world. What we actually sought to do was to recruit organizations, grassroots organizations that were working on corporate accountability, not on public health issues for the most part, right? On other consumer issues like pharmaceuticals or on environmental issues. And so when we started to work in the international arena and think about, you know, what kind of controls are going to be necessary to stop the export of this preventable epidemic, we look to organizations like Environmental Rights Action Nigeria, you know, which had been taking on Shell in the Niger Delta, and went out and met with them and said, look, you know, we think some precedents could be achieved through controlling the tobacco industry and its political power that would have implications for the transnational oil and gas corporations that you're fighting. And so that became a network called the Network for Accountability of Tobacco Transnationals. It's still active today.
You know, sometimes when we think of corporate campaigns, as you know, we'll have multiple tracks. And a lot of times I think of the multiple tracks in terms of, you know, there's the digital online, there's the field track, there's maybe a legislative track, a shareholder track, which you've alluded to. But it sounds like in this campaign, yes, there were those elements, but it was more that there were these subgroups. There's youth, there's international, there's public health. There's in general NGOs more broadly. Is that the proper way to think of the tracks of this campaign, or is it kind of a combination of both? Some was field, some was digital, some was legal, some was legislative.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what I'm talking about was pre-digital, right?
So yeah, of course.
There was always an important field component. So, you know, when we launched the campaign, one of the tactics was a small retailer campaign, where, you know, we were actually working with groups at the local level, to get them to engage with retailers in their community to take down tobacco advertising. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, that really was a great way to build capacity and leadership in the field. And it was pretty interesting because, I mean, there were a lot of payments to retailers to put these ads up, but a lot of them hadn't necessarily thought about the impact that they were having on young people coming into their shop. I mean, you think about the, you know, the mats on the counter, the displays. And so, you know, pretty early on in that campaign, one of the retailers that we were in touch with handed us a letter from that RJ Reynolds had sent around to its retailers, warning them about what was then in fact and the campaign, and calling us a small but vocal Boston-based band of zealots. You know, we took that as a bit of a badge of honor that RJR had to send this out to all their retailers, because people were, you know, people were out in the community. A lot of what I'm thinking about from the earlier days of the campaign was really providing toolkits, which of course now would be digital, but, you know, for people to be able to adapt in their own community and in their own country and in their own language. So, for example, we organized international weeks of resistance to tobacco transnationals, where we provided mini grants to groups in multiple countries where they then printed up banners and did marches or went and met with their ministers of public health, and people, you know, people took the common themes and messaging and really, you know, localized them.
That leads me to ask the question, you know, when you look out at the range of tactics that were employed internationally as well as nationally and by these different tracks of the campaign, are there certain ones that really stand out in terms of they generated a huge amount of media? They seem to help kind of shift the debate, kind of change the whole context for the debate in your favor.
A lot of it was seizing on opportunities. We were informing and supporting, you know, so for example, the trajectory of the campaign in the U.S. was such that we launched in April of 1994, the same month that Henry Waxman held these hearings with tobacco executives in the U.S. Congress, and just a month before the first healthcare cost recovery lawsuit was filed in Mississippi, seeking to hold the tobacco industry accountable for the costs of treating people with tobacco-related illness. And, you know, there were moments around that process of additional filings, which, you know, just rapidly sort of, most states really took on the tobacco industry once this legal theory developed. The tobacco companies, when they recognized they had won every case in court, right? And they had, you know, used their deep pockets to just pay lawyers to outlast any opponents. But they, you know, these cases quickly gained momentum, and so the tobacco companies shifted strategy and thought, like, okay, we better try to make these cases go away and get ourselves immunity from liability for these harms. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that debate over a settlement to these cases became in the U.S. a really important focal point for organizing and mobilizing. And ultimately, through the master settlement agreement with attorneys general, that a lot of what folks had been demanding through grassroots campaigning was secured. So, you know, I mean, people know that there were, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in penalties paid out to states through those lawsuits. But some of the other concessions that the industry was forced to make were the same ones that we and others in the movement had been putting forward. So they gave up particular advertising and promotional campaigns and tactics. You know, they gave up advertising on billboards, for example. And around that time, RJR Nabisco abandoned the Joe Camel campaign. As well. So, you know, really is changing what the landscape of advertising and promotion looked like in the U.S. In terms of the political influence through the settlements, they were forced to close the Tobacco Institute, their lobbying arm, for which they strong-armed Congress for decades. And they were also forced to close the Council for Tobacco Research, which had spun out bogus research, disputing the health harms of tobacco products. Raising that visibility, having people, you know, engaged and working in their communities and in particular constituencies, that really helped to ensure that the tobacco industry couldn't get off easy in making the cases filed by these states settled.
So when you look back on the campaign, there's positive and negative lessons we always learn, because you're engaged in a huge field experiment in a way, from which there are hypotheses going in, and there's results that either confirm or modify those hypotheses coming out. What do you think were some of the most significant positive and negative lessons learned that have implications for future campaigns and may have influenced future campaigns? In fact, no doubt.
For this campaign, it was critical that we took it on in a global context, right? As a U.S.-based organization, as a U.S.-based corporate accountability organization, what we didn't want was to win gains in the U.S. that would just mean that the abusive practices were, you know, magnified in other parts of the world. So I think, you know, seizing the opportunity when the Gro Harlem Brundtland became the director general of the World Health Organization, she made tobacco one of two cabinet level priorities for her term. And one of the first things that the World Health Organization did was an inquiry into the internal tobacco industry documents that had come out through litigation in the U.S. to see, you know, how had the tobacco industry tried to thwart the WHO itself in achieving its public health mission. So I think a key lesson for us was, you know, as in fact, with the campaign on infant formula and the Nestle boycott, we had played a role through the International Baby Food Action Network in the WHO's first code of marketing for a commercial product, the code of marketing for breast milk substitutes. And so when we saw WHO taking on this issue, it was actually an opportunity to use the WHO's treaty making powers for the very first time through the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. One of the things I really think about with corporate campaigning is you know, we organize and we mobilize around issues, help to put issues into the public eye. We seize opportunities to use visibility that the companies themselves are gathering to put pressure on them. And we know that there's going to be an arc of that visibility and organizing and mobilizing. And so to lock in those changes with enforceable mechanisms mm-hmm. for controlling corporate behavior. And I think especially transnational corporations, we need to be thinking about international mechanisms. And one of the greatest achievements of Challenging Big Tobacco campaign is a provision in the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control that obligates countries that ratify the treaty to protect their public health policies from interference by the tobacco industry. Going back to why did we take on this issue, one of the key reasons was the stranglehold over public policy decision making. So to have, globally, a recognition that this industry has a fundamental and irreconcilable conflict of interest with public health policy really put countries around the world in a stronger position to enact evidence-based public health policies. And it's such an important precedent for other industries whose products or practices are harmful, such as the fossil fuel industry, you know, where we're seeing now that the impacts of the conflict of interest that big oil has with effective climate policy, recognizing the importance of using the campaigning, the mobilization, the organizing to lock in those changes with enforceable mechanisms that will outlast you and me and everybody else who's taken to the streets on these campaigns. One of the things we all deal with in campaigns that seek to hold corporations accountable, stop their harmful practices, is morphing of corporate structures, right? So, you know, this campaign was seeking to use the Kraft and Nabisco food brands as leverage to pressure Philip Morris and RJ Reynolds. And, you know, ultimately both of them split apart from those food brands. So that's a victory in the sense that the tobacco industry doesn't get to hide behind those food brands, doesn't get to use Kraft macaroni and cheese as a way to, you know, gain access to policymakers. So it's definitely positive. It reduced their overall size as corporations. And at the same time, as corporations shape shift, right? And knowing that some of the corporate campaigns that have mobilized the most people are targeting reputations and brands. If they remove that public brand identity, it removes some leverage that we have over them. To the extent that they restructure and go private, for example, which we haven't seen here, but I think, you know, just for all of us looking ahead, what are going to be our strategies and tactics in campaigns where the corporations that are causing the most harm are controlled by private equity or what have you, or don't mm-hmm. have a brand that we can pressure. It's a win, and it then causes us to have to adapt our strategies. And I think with the Challenging Big Tobacco, they've also actually changed their own product line so that they're now purveyors of e-cigs and so, you know, also anticipating what do we do as they try to claim that they're part of the solution to the problem that they've created.
Mm-hmm. No, you make a really good point about how this campaign not only influences the evolution of corporate campaigns, for example, and making sure that we, as much as possible, take them internationally, or we try to lock in, institutionalize the victory so that the companies can't find a way to work around them. So that's one. But also that the companies themselves evolve. And I think shape-shifting, as you refer to it, is one of those disturbing characteristics of corporations and their ability to adapt in the system. I was going to ask you, as a kind of a final note, how do you think that the campaign, which really is one of the most seminal corporate campaigns in the last 50 plus years, how had it really influenced the evolution of corporate campaigns? But I think you've answered that question. Any final thoughts on this?
As a final thought, and it's related to kind of what are we taking on with corporate campaigns? I mean, through my 30 plus years of experience working on corporate campaigning now, so much of why transnational corporations get away with hurting and killing people is because they've rigged the system, because they exert too much influence over policymakers, because they've captured regulatory institutions. And so, I think the challenging big tobacco in actually looking at, how do we explicitly at a global level elevate public health over trade and industry interests, and how do we insulate our public interest policymaking process from interference and corporate conflicts of interest? That to me is it's the question of my lifetime. Every corporate campaign, and I'm currently taking on the fossil fuel industry and their role in driving the climate crisis, not only with the emissions from burning their products, but also with their campaigns of disinformation and deception. And so I think that, I mean, the tobacco industry was probably one of the earliest with the infamous "doubt is our product," right? We've got to continue getting out ahead of inoculating consumers and policymakers against disinformation and lies from corporations. And I see that problem only getting, only getting more challenging. We have social media. We have the capacity to call out corporate abuses in ways that, 30 years ago, with an example of abusive tobacco marketing, we had to have, someone would take a picture, mail the picture in, we would share it with our networks. Now that, now we have much more activists who are working and who have social media networks have the real capacity to call out greenwashing and disinformation in real time. And we need to use that because the corporations that we're taking on are getting ever more sophisticated about that, about their own disinformation, deception, and greenwashing, and using their deep pockets to advance that. The political influence and regulatory capture and the disinformation, greenwashing, bluewashing lies of corporations are going to be consistent challenges with any harm that corporations are doing to health, the environment, and human rights. We gotta apply lessons learned and adapt them for this time.
Agreed. And that actually seems like that question and that challenge seems to be actually the perfect place for us to end the interview. Kathy, thank you so much for providing us this insight into what I really consider to be one of the most iconic corporate campaigns certainly in the last 50 years. And it's so great to be able to talk to you and get those insights into the back channel, the behind the scenes, and what the NGO's role was and how it's influenced us. So again, thank you very much for taking the time for this interview.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Michael. It was fun to talk about it with you.
Before we end this podcast, enjoy this bonus content with Michael and Kathy, who continued their conversation.
If you've got just a couple more minutes,
yep.
One of the things people have said is that if the freshmen in college, for example, are debating whether they want to go into this field, that one of the things that they might really appreciate is a real candid hearing from people about why did we get into this field? Mm-hmm. And if you don't mind just taking a couple of minutes, you know, what was it that motivated you to get into this field and has kept you in the field for all these years?
Michael, I grew up at the height of the nuclear weapons buildup. And I was I saw a movie called The Day After when I was a senior in high school, and the existential threat of my youth was a nuclear holocaust. And so that was an issue that I got politicized around and that's where I first became an activist. I had this vague idea that I wanted to be an organizer. I didn't really know what that meant. And I started looking for jobs that would allow me to combine, learning organizing with taking on the issue of nuclear weapons. And at that time, in fact, corporate accountability was working on the General Electric boycott and hiring organizers out in Northern California. And so I jumped in. I got to learn really basic relational person-to-person organizing out on the streets in Oakland, carrying an ironing board to sign people up to the GE boycott. And it was through the lens of that issue and coming to see the power and influence that General Electric had, that I came to understand the issue of transnational corporate capitalism as what I needed to take on as my mission and life's work. And so companies getting away with hurting and killing people, I guess my work has always been about taking on the bad guys and trying to get them out of the way so that, people's movements and people who are building sustainable economies at the local level actually have a chance to do that. And, I think I've stuck with it because I learned from some really good teachers how to do corporate campaigns in a way that is effective, and to break down a massive global problem into something that people can do today with other people in their community and make progress toward solving it. So that's,
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah, we grew up at the same, in many ways, the same time. My nuclear freeze movement was my first real, besides Vietnam, the nuclear freeze movement post Vietnam was really my first real engagement and getting into the whole idea of organizing and being in action with other people. And then also you're right. As soon as this happened, also with rainforest work, as soon as you start to see the power and the bullying power of corporations, there's something that I have said that as a guy who came out of being a corporate consultant for several years, that as soon as I started doing some rainforest work and I went, it radicalized me to see, it wasn't RAND that radicalized me, it was learning what corporations were doing to forests, to native communities around the world, their control of government that really radicalized me. And I mean radicalized in the most positive sense of saying, we need to go to the roots, which is the etymology of radical.
Yeah.
The term radical is we need to go to the roots of the problem.
Thank you for listening to Reining in the Bulls with Michael Marks. To learn more about Union of Concerned Scientists and how they use science to address global problems and improve people's lives, please visit them at ucsusa.org. Thank you for listening to the Reining in the Bulls podcast. Unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited and may not be used without express written permission. CEI, Corporate Ethics International, and Reining in the Bulls. Copyright 2024, all rights reserved.